Hello and welcome to Boothcast. This Boothcast is brought to you by Vicobi Ocean Performance. Now, these guys have the best on-water technical apparel in the business. They'll keep you warm, they'll keep you cool, they'll keep you feeling comfortable and during all your paddling sessions, whether on OC1, surf ski, SUP, you name it, they've got the product for it. So if you want to find out more, please check out www.vicobi.com. And now I'm going to throw you over to Vicobi's founder and owner, Patrick Langley. Hello and welcome to Boothcast. On Boothcast, I speak to people about sport, business, and the winning mindset. Today on Boothcast, I have managing director and founder of Vicobi Oceans Performance, Pat Langley. He's also a sailor from a young age. He has a whole host of experience in apparel, manufacturing, marketing, and all those types of things. He's got a business degree. He's a very big name on the paddling scene through his brand Vicobi, and it's really great to have a chat with him today. So, Pat, thanks for coming on.
Oh, Boothie, nice intro, mate. And, thanks for inviting me. I tell you what, I've been listening to all the Boothcasts, many of them as I can get through anyway. You've been producing a lot of them, but I really enjoy them. So well done to you, mate.
Yeah, thanks. It's been really cool to chat to so many people, and I'm just learning so much about different people that I probably wouldn't have known otherwise. And that's exactly the same thing that's what's happened already this morning, reading through your bio and seeing all the different things that you've done. So it's going to be nice for the listeners and the viewers to sort of hear a bit behind the man who runs Vicobi and sort of has a big part and stakeholdership in the sport of ocean paddling and sailing now as well. So we're going to hear a little bit about your story. So to start off, can you give a little bit of a snapshot to the listeners about who you are, what you do, and where you're from?
Yeah, well, yeah, look, my name's Pat Langley. I think I'm 42 now, so still young enough to feel like I'm young anyway. But
just keep telling yourself that. That's the way to be.
Exactly. You just got to keep telling yourself you're young, I think. That's the key from what I see. I'm married. I've got a lovely wife, Adie, who's actually involved in the business. I'm sure we'll talk about her a lot. Got two kids, Beth and Abby. I think they're 11 and 9, so we're in that age. I'm the founder and owner of Vicobi, which we started in 2016. Spent my whole life around the water. You know, sailing has been a big part of my life, Boothie, and now I'm a mad paddler. I'm a mid-pack paddler, I'd say. Sometimes if I train a bit, I might get a little bit ahead of the mid-pack, but I'm a bit back. Yeah. So but I love it, and you know, paddling's a big part of my life, and I've had a great career outside of sport as well, in business, which I feel like I've got a long way to go. In fact, you know, I feel like I'm literally just at the early stages still.
Yeah, so you're basically living your dream through your passion of ocean sports and doing the business called Vicobi, which has a lot of technical apparel and that type of thing. But I want to go back to a bit towards the start of when you were growing up doing sailing, and you were sort of inspired by your father, who was a business owner himself. And there was like lots of lessons I gave us, obviously, that you were learning as a kid, but also learning how to be on the ocean, racing in a whole bunch of different classes in sailing. Can you give us a bit of insight into that and how that all started and why you had such a love for the ocean, the wind and boats?
Yeah, good question, because I think that is kind of the start of, you know, I think Vicobi probably came from back there, really. We were brought up here on the northern beaches of Sydney, and Newport, which is... it's a great spot. It's on a peninsula. So on one side, you've got the ocean, you know, the surf beaches where, you know, guys like Tom Carroll and all the legends would hang. And then you've also got the Pittwater side, which is great for sailing. And being brought up there, you had the best of both worlds. And so everybody did something around the water. You know, you weren't surfing, you were sailing, you were windsurfing, you were doing anything really. So... I was really fortunate in that way. I was also fortunate to have a great family, a big family. I'm one of four kids, got two older brothers and a younger sister, and we're all into that sort of stuff as well. And, you know, two hardworking parents. So, you know, you mentioned my dad had his own business, and I think, you know, he was a inspiration there, and, you know, but very much a hard worker, both my mum and dad. And I think all our my siblings have that, they've gone into successful careers, probably more so than me in many ways. But you know, we had this upbringing around the water that was just unreal. And sailing, my two older brothers were into sailing, and I followed them at a very young age and just got into it. I was not very competitive at all. I just loved being around the club, loved getting on the water. If I was asked to go sailing with anyone, I'd do it. And that's where it really began.
Yeah, and you basically just chased your brothers around, I'm sure, like I did as a young fella, and sort of saw my older brother getting involved in surf lifesaving. And that was basically how I started. And I was running around the beach building sandcastles before I could probably walk. But it's something that's, I guess, ingrained in you that you want to sort of chase your older brothers and sort of compete against them and beat them. And then when did you start to be a little bit more competitive at the sailing, and what sort of events were you getting involved with before you went to university?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because you basically start in junior classes. So you start in, you know, centre boards. We have these boats around here called Manly Juniors and Flying 11s and Lasers. And so we basically, you progress through the classes. And you know, I was certainly just, I was just somewhere there on the water having a good time and being part of it. But as you got into sort of your teenage years, you got a little bit more competitive. And the club that I was at, the Royal Prince Alfred Yacht Club, they created this program called the Youth Development Program, and it was basically designed for to take kids to the next level and, you know, really teach them how to be competitive sailors across all types of boats, but a lot of yacht racing as well. And so, yeah, we all of a sudden went to having these opportunities where we got to, you know, not only sail dinghies but yachts and ocean racing and match racing and keelboats and all different types of boats. And I was the youngest, I was one of the youngest anyway in that group. And for me, it was a game changer. I learned so much. That's where I think I really started to learn how to be competitive, but also learn a lot about myself as to how, you know, being around a lot of these older people and great coaches. We got these opportunities to start racing, you know, in California and New Zealand, which are, you know, America and New Zealand are, you know, one of the, you know, and Australia as well, and Europe, but are, you know, very competitive in sailing. So we got opportunities to do that and meet people around the world, and you know, they even had world championships for match racing, youth match racing as well, and we started to compete in those. So, you know, I think we got second in New Zealand. 1 year, and you know, it's just that was really the beginning of it, and I think a lot of us all started to think, oh well, professional sailing, which actually is a, you know, pretty you know, there are guys that do very well out of it, and there's a lot of guys that get along with it, and but you know, I think everyone that went through that program sort of harbored a desire to be a professional sailor at some point.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of young kids out there wanting to be a professional sailor, and you look up to these America's Cup style races. And I had Anders Gustafsson on recently talk on the Boothcast talking about being America's Cup sailor, but that's sort of like the pinnacle of the sport. But there's obviously a lot of grinders out there, not the actual guys on the boat, but guys who are just grinding and sort of journeymen and trying to make it to the big time, but probably aren't getting there. When did you start to realize that sailing probably wasn't going to be your focus anymore, and you wanted to sort of move into the business realm?
Yeah, good question. Not for some time, actually. Look, you know, being in our family, you know, going to degree, going getting a business degree or getting a degree of some description was a non-negotiable. You know, you had to do it. And so, you know, when I finished school, I went to St. Augustine's, which was a great school here. And actually, I think there's a few paddlers that went to St. Augustine's. I know Mitchell Trim, JR is another one.
Okay.
Colin Hamilton, he's a paddler from around here. Anyway, it was a good school.
JR, the Vice Ducks.
The Vice, that's him, the Vice Ducks.
The Vice Ducks. Yeah. Yeah, very good.
Exactly, his name was on the board when I walked in.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, university was great fun. And for me, when I did it, I was like, oh, this is great. I'll get another 3 years of this whole sailing game. This is great. So I certainly was doing it, but I had started to build a bit of an interest in, I guess, marketing and the psychology of selling, so to speak, and branding. I really love brands and how do brands exist and how they differentiate themselves. And and all that sort of stuff. So I had an interest in that, and so that was probably the beginning of that. But certainly, I think I still at that stage, I think I still wanted to do the sailing thing, and I probably wasn't real with myself, really knowing whether I was going to be good enough. But you're certainly going to try. And so yeah, and then I finished university, and I got this opportunity I got a contract to go and race for this, live in Japan and race for this sailing team up there. And it was a company that had a sailing program, and I thought to myself, well, this could be a great opportunity to start that whole professional sailing thing.
Yeah, can you unpack your professional sailing career a little bit more? Like, I know you're speaking about going and racing in New Zealand, racing in America, and doing this yachting stint, obviously, over in Japan. But you sort of have a long international career. Like, how long did that span for? And what were sort of like the highlight events that you went to and results that you had?
Yeah, well, you're right. Like, I think we started competing literally from about 16. You started to go off to races. I think a lot of the highlights were around... like Australian match racing championships and youth match racing championships, and also in Japan, we won those a lot while we're up there. There was a world match racing tour, and that was basically the breeding ground of a lot of the America's Cup sailors, a lot of the skippers. You'd come up and race against them at different events. They had different tiers of events. So you certainly got plenty of opportunity to go and race against some of these big names. And you'd occasionally scrap a win, but they were class acts, those guys. And I think for me, it's just such a broad sport. There's so many factors. Like, it's a hard sport to explain to people because there's so many different aspects of it, so many different classes and divisions. And but doing ocean racing and some of the big ocean races, we do like the Sydney Hobart, which you probably everyone knows about that one. They call that the great race. There's not many races out there that are better than that one. There's ocean races in Europe. We do these races. These races that start in like the Isle of Capri and go around a volcano down off Sicily and back, these crazy places, or the Maxi Worlds in Porto Cervo, in Sardinia. And you're surrounded by all these boats. It must be literally billions of dollars of boats, and there's one marina. It's mind-boggling, and it's a big world. So certainly there's been some legends in the sport that I've sort of got to know, and it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you have this extended sailing career, and you're doing all these different races, and you've sort of brushed over a couple of match racing national titles there, junior and senior. Can you unpack that for us a little bit and explain to me what match racing is? You said sailing is quite a complicated sport, and I guess as an outsider looking in like myself, my first knowledge of sailing really was seeing Nathan Outeridge. He was I think a Newcastle sailor, and we used to go to the Lake Macquarie Sports Awards, and he used to win everything because he was winning all the sailing events, and that was my first experience of sailing. And I think he's on the America's Cup boats now. He's a helmsman, or what are they called when they steer the boat?
He's a helmsman, and he's become one of the world's best sailors. He's a freak. Actually, plenty of great sailors from your part of the world, Boothie. Lake Macquarie has bred plenty of good ones.
Yeah. Can you explain those different classes for us a little bit, and explain the ones that you were actually competing in?
Yeah. So look, you've got, fundamentally, you've got two types of racing going on, and course racing, which would be sort of like a race that might last 40 minutes to an hour or so. And that's, so you've got fleet racing, where you've got as many boats as you can pack on a race course. And then you've got match racing, which is two boats. And match racing is very much like what the America's Cup is, where you've got boat on boat racing. And it's very tactical. You're basically trying to force the other boat into an error. There's lots of rules, and it tends to be a bit of yelling as well, which can be interesting, but it's more, some of the smarter older blokes use it as intimidation, it's very tactical, and I really enjoyed that part. I think that was a sort of an area that I became very strong at, was match racing and becoming a match racing helmsman. So but the fleet racing bits, amazing, and the best sailors in the world are the guys that can just cross over everything. And sailing's changed so much over the last know, the last 20 years, you know, we've gone from sailing, you know, keelboats and boats that go upwind at sort of, you know, 6 knots, 7 knots, and now they're foiling upwind at 30 knots. You know, it's, yeah. The sport has changed, and, you know, the good guys have been able to, you know, adapt and evolve with that. It's been amazing to watch.
Yeah, it's quite incredible to see those big, either the Supermaxis going down to Super, like Sydney to Hobart Racing, or you have the foiling boats going upwind at 30 knots. It's quite incredible, considering that if we're paddling upwind, we're probably going about 6 or 7 knots. So it's a very, very different world now, I'm sure, from what you were doing back probably in the 90s type of thing when you were doing your biggest sailing stint of your career. Can you... So you've done the Sydney to Hobart. Can you explain that a little bit? And how many times have you done it? And what's it like? Were you a helmsman for that race, or were you a deckhand? Like, what are the positions, I guess, on a boat? Because I know you played rugby league as well. So let's, I guess, give it to me like a rugby league team.
Well, hang on, it's rugby Boothie, not rugby league.
Rugby league. They're all the same, aren't they? One's a bit slower than the other.
Exactly. Look, the Sydney to Hobart, yeah. So look, I guess it's a race that you want to do. I think it's been a race that I've always only wanted to do it when I've got a great team to sail with and on a really well-prepared boat that you're going to have a chance of winning. And the two times I've done that race, I was fortunate that I did have great teams. And so, yeah, look, I invariably, you know, there's a lot of ocean races that happen around that race as well. So it's just one of many. But generally I would be, you know, somewhere in the, you know, you'd have watch captains. So you're not racing all the time. So you're not on deck all the time. You would rotate shifts because you're sailing the boat 24/7. So you might have, you know, two teams and, you're rotating the crew around, the whole time. So I was often, you know, watch captain and, you know, that involved everybody to be a good ocean race. You've got to be able to do all the positions in the boat, you know, and everybody's got to, you've got to be multi-skilled and the best guys, the guys that are prepared to do anything, you know, you'll empty the bilge, you can steer, you can trim, you can run up the bow, you can change, repack spinnakers. You've got to be a multi-talented sailor to be good at ocean racing. So the two boats that I went on, I was fortunate, a good mate of mine had a FAR 40 and so the way, actually, this is another one to make sailing more complicated. You've got ocean, you've got line honours, right? So you see the big maxis and it's first across the line, right? So Yep. Where's the biggest and fastest wins. But the real race in ocean racing is what they call the overall handicap. And basically every boat has a handicap based on their size, their speed, and some of their design characteristics. And that's the one that everyone's trying to win. So you could be in a 40 footer and you could win the race. But on that 40 footer, the conditions didn't suit our particular boat that year. It was more for a bigger boat. It's all about what time you arrive at the Derwent River. If you arrive at 11 o'clock at night, you're going to drift down the river and you're going to stop. Whereas if you arrive at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and rip up the river in 2 hours or an hour and a half and finish before the sun goes down, you're in a much better position. So it's got a lot of luck around ocean racing. It really does. It's the hardest trophy to win, that one. The second one actually was on the TP52 Ragamuffin with Sid Fisher. I think a lot of people know of him. And that was, I think, getting close to his last couple on that boat. So pretty fascinating because, you know, Sid getting pretty old, and I clearly remember the first night, and we'd done a lot of other races, but I remember the first night in the Hobart, you know, this is a guy, he must have been 80 at this stage, and he's well known, and, you know, he used to be an ex-boxer and a bit of a tough guy and had a career in business. But anyway, you're into the first night and it's sort of getting to, sun's gone down, and you've had a big day getting out of the Sydney Harbour and you're off the coast. It's like, oh, Sid, you should go and have a rest. No, I'm not going. I've got to make sure these bastards don't slack it off. Okay. Yeah. A couple of hours later, how are you going, Sid? Yeah, good. Yeah. And then, you know, he stays up all night just to check that everyone doesn't slack off. But then that's it. He goes down and you don't see him for the rest of the race. he was in the bunk for the rest of the race. So that was pretty interesting experience. But yeah, so good fun ocean racing. And you know, that's something you keep doing. I'm sure I've got plenty more ahead of me.
Yeah, and are you still sailing now? Like, is something like about sailing that you really enjoy? And I know you've done this from a young age. And is it the thrill of the boat? Is it going at the speed? Is it the tactics? Is it the competition? Like, what do you really like about sailing? Like, what kept you going for such a long time?
Yeah, it is. It's a competition without a doubt. Everyone loves to do their best and to be competitive. I haven't raced that much in the last. Well, how long has Bikovi been around for? 8 years. So the last 8 years, mate, it's probably been a little less than that. I was lucky enough, probably up until about 6 years ago, we had a Swiss owner and he had a Mini Maxi 72, and we did about four seasons racing, four major events in Europe, and so that was fortunate. I really enjoyed that campaign, and we were racing against some of the best sailors in the world. But since then, our business has just grown and actually, to be honest, I've fallen in love with ocean paddling. And having young kids as well, it's a very time consuming sport. It can be a bit selfish as well. You go away and say, "Hi, family, I'm off for 2 weeks. We're doing a regatta here," or "I'm off for a weekend." it's just the time of life. It's just one of those things. So I think, yeah, for me, I'm probably having a bit of a hiatus on sailing, but without a doubt, it's a sport you can do until you die. So I'll be back there for sure. But, you ask about what really drives you to do it. It's definitely the camaraderie and the team thing. The people that you meet, the great people you get to sail with. Yeah, I used to love it. You'd be on a boat and you might have an investment banker and then you'll have a guy on the dole. Like, at every level of the spectrum, you've got someone, but on the boat, everyone's equal. You all got to make a contribution. If one person makes a mistake, the team loses out. So it's just such a leveler, and I think that's the bit that everyone enjoys.
Yeah, it would be nice to obviously have like the different levels of society on one boat, and you sort of show that it doesn't really matter how much money you earn once you're out in the ocean. It's a very, very good leveler. And that's like when even in ocean racing and surf ski paddling, like it doesn't matter who you are, where you're from. If you're a good paddler, you get respected in the way that you deserve, and that's the way it should be. So you've obviously had a long sailing career. So you basically stopped sailing around 34. So you basically had this 18-year sailing career in a way.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way. So, yeah, so that's quite a way.
Yeah, so, yeah, because I was trying to sort of work it out when you were talking, because like, obviously you were bouncing around for different events, different times and that type of thing. But were you working all the way through your sailing career as well? Because you jump into a business degree, you major in marketing, you say you're enjoying the branding and you're enjoying the way that business work. Was that, in a way, did you learn that through sailing? Like, because you say you really like the camaraderie, you really like working with people. So that might have led you into a little bit into business. Then you like competition, which is business as well, because you see a lot of sports people go into business because it becomes competitive, because mm-hmm. you want to be better than the other guy. You want to create a product that people like. You want to be, relatable and doing all those types of things. What were the different jobs you had along the way that sort of led you into creating your own brand with Bikovi?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think all of those things make a contribution to what you do, what you love. I think probably if you sort of go back to the Japan experience, I went up there and that was that opened my eyes. And I think that's where I really went, you know what? I don't think professional sailing is probably what I'm going to end up doing.
And what year was this?
That was not long after I finished university, I think. This must have been in the early 2000s.
Yep.
And I think probably there, I was really put out of my comfort zone. I might as well have landed in Mars. I was living in this town that I was probably the only non-Japanese person there. There was a couple of Kiwis that I became friends with. But, it was quite a experience where I had to learn a lot and think, learn a lot about myself. And I think out of that, I started to form an opinion of what I wanted to do. And I think the business of sport really fascinated me, and that was something that really resonated with me, that I was interested in, and obviously the marketing and all that sort of thing. So I certainly wasn't going to go into a job selling nuts and bolts. You know, it had to be something that was interesting and that I had a passion to connect into. And so I came back from there and I thought, well, okay, let's get this going. And so I started this business based here in Sydney called Classic. And Classic was, you've probably seen it on the rugby league jersey. So we had seven of the NRL teams, all their on-field kit, and we had the rights to sell that kit in the market. So I was a sales cadet, literally the junior guy, and but I loved it. It taught me about, you know, the need to have enthusiasm and energy when you with what you do. And it wasn't a big business, but it had lots of different aspects, and I got to start to get experiences to every part of the business, and learn. So that was a really good starting point. You know, you got to start at the bottom, and I certainly did there, and it was great fun. From there, I got an opportunity to move to a business based in Melbourne called Playcorp, and we had the rights for all the NRL and AFL supporter kit, and so it was in sports licensing still, but they also had the rights to some brands like Everlast and Under Armour here in Australia, and Under Armour was still pretty formative at that point, but you know, getting this experience to see how some of the bigger companies do it was, you know, really really fascinating. And and so, you know, once again, you learn a little bit there and take away those bits. Then I had this opportunity to move to this company called Lion 7, and it was owned by a guy called Ross Munro. He's a well-known identity in New Zealand business and sailing. And he had this brand. It was a very iconic brand in New Zealand sailing and Australian sailing, international sailing, really had a lot of history. And they also had the rights to this UK brand called Musto. And Roscoe had actually just lost the rights for it. He lost it after having it for 15 years. And he said, look, I've got an opportunity here for you, Pat. I've got $2.5 million of Musto stock we're going to get rid of. And we're going to start our own Lion 7 brand, again, in the technical sort of sailing gear space. So you want it. This is going to be an interesting one. But I took that on, and that was, you know, once again, you know, another great learning. You learn from all these people along the way. And, you know, we set up that brand in the technical sailing space, got the distribution going, got very involved with the product development and sourcing side and the marketing side. And so, you know, it's all of a sudden, those pieces of puzzle start to come into place. And that ended actually in an interesting way. Ross, he was a force, and he's been very successful in business onwards. He'd worked out that licensing was the way to go. He had the licenses for the Rugby World Cup and America's Cup and Olympic Games, and I think that's where he's been so successful. But the Lion 7 business had a retail arm of stores in Westfield malls, and they weren't going that great. And they were really struggling. So the business went into receivership, and having observed that from a distance, slightly a distance, because we were in a different division, but observing that was a real learning, you know, for me anyway. So, and then I had this great opportunity. I saw that sort of tumbling down, and then I got to know some guys here in Sydney with a startup sailing brand here called Zyke, which I think many people would know of it, particularly in the sailing world. It's become one of the, you know, the strongest brands in sailing. And at that stage, that was very much in startup mode. The founder, Brian Connolly, was a really intelligent and great marketer, really good marketer, quite eccentric character. I'm sure he won't mind me saying so. And he had the X factor really to create that brand. And at that point, there was only sort of three of them, and they didn't have a sales and marketing guy. Well, that Brian was definitely involved in marketing, but they didn't have a salesperson that was really driving the distribution. So I joined those guys and bought over a lot of my contacts and a few contracts, and then got involved in that business. And that was 4 years of just really good times, you know, building the distribution network globally and creating this brand that became really strong.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of lessons there that you sort of can talk about. So you go over to Wakayama in Japan, and that sort of probably was a massive cultural shock for you as well, because I know going to Japan myself, like nobody really speaks English. You communicate through somebody else generally. Like I'm lucky enough when I go over to Japan, we have some really great reps from Starboard Japan that look after me the whole time I'm there. So I just have a really good time because they understand me and I understand them, but nobody else understands me, which makes it really pleasant experience. But if you're going over there by yourself solo, it can be quite a daunting experience because for whatever reason, Japanese culture doesn't really have a lot of English and probably less of when you were over there in the early 2000s. Was that an experience that really opened your mind up to building a brand and distribution network, like in learning the different cultural values that are in different markets?
Yeah, actually it was. And if I think about it in that way, you're right. You would have been big in Japan, Boothie, mate. They would have loved you there.
But, yes. I do feel special when I go to Japan, that's for sure.
Actually, I've got to tell you, I did have an inquiry this morning from Japan from people wanting some of the new Vicobi booth collection. So you
excellent.
Do have
plans.
Yep, yeah. There is. But no, actually, so working for a business, working for an owner of a business up there, the Kawaguchis, actually, it was a husband and wife that owned the company. They didn't have any kids. So I think the sailing team sort of was one of their, part of the family. You really did become part of the family, but you got to observe their business. And I found that fascinating. And, this is back in the time where people had jobs for life in Japan. They literally would stay with the companies. Loyalty was huge, changed. Now, things have changed a lot there now. But back then, it was probably getting to the end of that period. And just observing Japanese business and culture, and even in the team dynamic as well, the seniority, you had to, I certainly came a cropper a few times there, not respecting that in the team and not, the age and all those sorts of things was really important. So yeah, you learn a lot up there, and I think while you learn a lot about cultures, you learn a lot about yourself and you sort of think as to how we do it. Why do we do it?
Yeah.
I couldn't put a value on that time. Went up there for different reasons. I thought I was going to be, doing some professional sailing, but actually I think I came back with a whole lot more knowledge about a lot of other things.
So living over there and obviously embracing the culture in Japan, how was that whole experience? And did you achieve the sailing goals that you went out to achieve? Because I know that was like your game changer moment where you were like, right, I want to go down this different path of business. And you came back from Japan and like, okay, that's my new goal, just to own my own business and to actually make that successful. What made you change really? What was there any defining moments, or was it just, I don't think I'm going to be a sailor, but I'm really interested in business? Like, was it something like that?
Good question. I think it probably was over time. I think at the same time, there was other sailing going on in the world as well, which I wasn't part of because I was doing what I was doing in Japan. And I could see that sort of ship kind of sailing in some ways. We had some good guys that from our program that I used to sail against that have went on and had successful careers. And like actually a good guy, I'm sure you've heard of him, a guy by the name of James Spithill, he was like my sparring partner in match racing, and he was so driven. And if I look back at it now, he's on another level. He's at Boothie level, And if I was really honest with myself, and I think I was like, I want sailing to be my passion, not my job. And I think that's what spurred the desire to what was I passionate about? What could I get passionate about? And I think that's where the business of sport is what sort of started to get me.
Yeah. So when you say you were like his sparring partner, were you racing against each other or were you in the same team?
A bit of both. So yeah, we used to have that youth development program and down in RPA, we'd have match racing battles and we'd have different teams and you were literally fighting for the spots, to go away to events. And so, yeah, he was steering another boat. He was a year younger than me. And so we had years of battles. And then he was, and then he started progressing, and then we all started sailing with him and doing events. And so that's just how it all sort of, it was just an amazing time, really. And, you know, we've got a lot of other good mates. You know, we've got a really good mate of mine. He's still a professional sailor, racing on, you know, all these boats. You know, it can provide a lifetime of opportunity for sure.
And but what is the difference between you and, say, James? Like, what was the defining, like you say, he's like Boothie, that, like, what does that even mean? Like, what are you trying to say when you say, like, he had that extra drive, he had that more determination, or did he want it more, or was he more talented? Like, what was the difference between you and him? Because I know, obviously, you did it for 18 years, so you wanted to be there, but I guess you'd learn over time. Like, what was the difference?
I think he had the hunger that I didn't for achieving what he wanted. He was really clear about what he wanted to achieve and knew it. Yep. It from age, and I don't think I did. So I think it's great that you can you know what you want, what you can and can't do, you know. Yep. You know, I think for me the hard work the real hard work that you need to put in to be successful sort of came for me a little later, or the understanding of what you really needed to do to be successful. And I think for him, he knew it at 15. He was into it. and you see him now, he's still been pretty successful in sailing across all the disciplines as the sport's evolved. It's been very impressive.
Yeah, I know the name just through the America's Cup and just following that the World Sailing Series or something they had last year on the foils. So
Sail GP,
and then obviously seeing Kai and Anders being involved, that sort of sparked my interest a little bit more. But yeah, it's cool to see that sort of connection and how small the world is in a way. But so you find your hunger a little bit later on and you create your own brand, because I would say that you're very determined, you're very passionate, and you're sort of combining all these different values that you've learned over your time. You might say that you didn't have that drive and determination necessarily when you were sailing, but you wanted to do it, but you didn't want it to be your job necessarily. But now I think, and from knowing you and working with you for the past nearly 8 years, I think it's been pretty much since you started by Kobe. What changed there, and why? Because now I'd say you're super determined. Like, you want to get out there, you want to win, you want to have the best product, you want to work as hard as you can, you want to be consistent. Like, you're doing all these things that I would say like an A-grade athlete would do with their training and their racing to be the best. And you're trying to do that. You've created a niche. You found a niche in the sport, and you've attacked it, and you're winning. Like, there's no doubt about that. What was it like creating Vicobi, and how is all these lessons that you've learned over time, not only sailing but working at these different brands, that you've been able to implement into this really, really successful business?
I think it's when you know what you want to do, then it becomes easy, right? Well, not easy, but you know, when you know what you want to do and you want to, you can see the direction you want to go, I think that's when the magic starts to happen. And I think that's what it was for me. I think I probably wanted to be a sailor, but I don't think I really, you know, if you were really honest, you know, and I see that in athletes as well today. I can see the guys that are going to win and those that are not, and you can see it. They haven't got it. They haven't found that bit yet, you know? So coming to Vicobi, I think the stars had aligned. There's a few reasons why Vicobi, it was always going to happen. It was just a matter of when, and life, like everything, gets in the way a little bit. You know, I was married, 89, I got married, and then we'd had Beth, and then we had Abby, and 80 has had a very successful career in finance and in the finance world with CommBank, and I was off running around growing the Vicobi business, the Zyc business, sorry, at that point. And, you know, you can't have two parents that have full on jobs. And I think the realization for us was like, hey, something's got to change. And so it was like, well, now's the time to start Vicobi. So, you know, I literally started that, and what Vicobi was going to be, and even the brand Vicobi wasn't created yet, but we it had to be ocean related. It had to be something that we're passionate about. And I'd actually started paddling surf skis just before I started. I'd had a beaten up Burton surf ski and then a Fen Millennium. And I used to just paddle them for fitness and just, you know, just do it for fun. I don't think I might do the odd time trial here and there, but I could see a sport that was still evolving. I didn't know Dean Gardner and all those guys that well at all. I knew of him. But I could see a sport that was evolving, but I couldn't see any brand that was, I guess, creating all the gear and excitement and all the technical gear in a way that I thought we could do it. And I saw that as an opportunity. And then I started looking at all the other aspects of paddling outside of surf ski and thought, you know, I think there's an opportunity there. And so Vicobia was created and we set about creating a range and hit the market. And that was not long after I think I met you, Boothie.
Yeah, it was great to meet you in the early days and like just seeing how much the products have improved and changed and evolved over time. It's been a great to be part of that journey for most of the way. But what was it about, like obviously you had the change, you had a wife, you had two young kids, you were running around the world and she was working heavily in finance. What was that? Was there a pinnacle moment? Was there one like day you just woke up and went, right, like we're going to do this, we're going to commit, we're going to throw all our finances into it and just see what happens? Or was it, we'll gradually move into it? Like what was there a big, I don't know, light bulb moment?
It was a gradual process. It was a gradual process of, where you just, you know, I think you just get to a point in your life where you're like, right, it's now or never, let's do it. You know, we let's not wait. Let's just do it. And I think that just getting on with it has been the key. You know, and I've discovered, but you just got to go and create the opportunity and just do it. If you sit around talking about it for too long, nothing will ever happen. And I think it just the reality of, you know, of living in finances. We live in Sydney. It's not the most cheapest place to live. And you actually know that was a reality. That's why we sent 80, poor at 80 back to work after maternity leave and she was earning more than I was.
Yeah.
And I think that was really the pivotal moment, but also the desire to go and create something really special and unique. Look, you never know when you start these things how successful they're going to be, but I guess I had all experience over the years at different parts of different businesses, I knew enough to know what we needed to do, and what I didn't know, I learned. And then learning has been the biggest thing over the last 8 years. Just all the different things you've got to learn when you're running a business. It's been quite humbling in some ways.
Yeah. So starting off in 2013, would you say was that when you started off? Or was it 2012?
Yeah, we started developing the brand in late 2012. We launched in March 2013. I still remember the day. Actually, going backwards a little bit, Tim Jacobs was a good mate of mine from school. We had a mutual school friend. We got to know each other pretty well. And so I knew he was an awesome paddler. And when the idea for Vicobia sort of started to really take shape, I got in touch with TJ and said, mate, we're doing this and we could do this sort of product, and he was really helpful at sort of just helping us go in the right direction and making a few introductions, and so TJ was our first star athlete, you know, and he was coaching Murray Stewart at the time, so Muzza was also involved as our first athletes, but we kept it really under wraps. We didn't let anyone know about what we're doing. We didn't want anyone else to sort of. I thought, actually, this is a really good opportunity that I don't want anyone else to kind of get in there. So we kept it quiet and we launched the brand. And I still remember the first day we bailed up at a local race here at Middle Harbour and brought all the stock out, thinking, okay, here we go. And people started buying it. And I was like, oh, okay, it's pretty good. So, yeah. And then, you know, pretty quickly after that, we already had actually a really good dealer here in Sydney, Matt Blundell at Pro Kayaks, and he's remained our, you know, best dealer in the world actually. But we just started from there. The relationships began, and we developed a distribution network. And yeah, you know, I took a lot of the same processes that I've taken in other, you know, more my other career, and just the brand just started to build.
So as a business owner and starting out, how important is secrecy of a brand but before you're starting to launch it and keeping it close to wraps? Because I know there's different methods. Obviously, you can go out there and you can sort of start creating a lot of noise when you don't really have anything and seeing if the people grab on, and then you can actually launch and get involved with it, or you can take that approach that you had. Do you think that was a really important decision that you made to sort of keep it under wraps and sort of really like exponentially grow from a quick release?
Good question. Yeah, I believe that you got to put your best foot forward. So I didn't want to launch until we had our best foot to put forward, and we knew that all our ducks were in line, so to speak. So I think if you're going to do it, you got to do it properly. And I think that's probably more of what it was about, is making sure that when we did it properly. We had everything, you know, looking at the level that we wanted to look at. You know, I look back now at some of our products and they're all perfectly functional, but our range looks a lot different these days. So
yeah, they've come a long way, that's for sure. I remember coming with some of the early products and they weren't quite where they are today.
Yeah, but you know, people love them, and we're feeling a need in the market, and functionally, like our V cold pan has been around since day one. It just has evolved slightly. You know, and it was good times. I think from that period we started to get to know like a lot of athletes like yourself. I think, you know, you were really one of our first ones, and I remember you off to Canada and you're doing a trip around the US, and you know, and people were starting to see our athletes wearing our gear overseas. I remember in 2013, actually, the year TJ went to the Worlds in Portugal and Sean Rice got him, and I was watching that thinking, oh, you know, it'd be great if we win our first World Championship our first year, you know. And then, and then Sean, actually, who actually has become one of our major ambassadors over time, we've got to know Sean really well as a good friend, but Sean beat TJ that day. But, you know, it's just as time, we got involved with a lot of different athletes. We and our network grew, and but we were ready there to be able to distribute and supply. Like, we always made sure that we had product, and we had our ability to get the product to market and do it in an easy way for the dealers. And I think that's the key. We were very professional from the beginning as to the execution of you know, the business.
Yeah, and you've obviously had a lot of experience working for like the four other companies, I think it was, and you're sort of learning through their, I guess, learnings and their mistakes and their successes, and you can sort of formulate a plan in your mind. But when you're actually having to implement it itself, it probably was a little bit more daunting than actually taking someone else's product and going, oh, well, if it happens, it happens. I still get my salary, you know, like, whereas this time it's your finances. You're like going, okay, well, I'm hoping for a 50% return or 100% return or whatever return you're looking at, and you're taking a lot more risk. Was that daunting at the time, or you knew that this is going to work?
It was, yeah, incredibly daunting. And actually, I probably didn't need to worry about someone else coming into our market, because I since found out how bloody hard it was, you know, like financially setting this up. You know, I think we scrapped together 25 grand for our first block. And jump on that. And I think that, you know, and then literally, you know, trying to feed your family and fund the cash flow for a growing business, that's been the hardest part throughout all of this. And it forces you to become pretty disciplined. You know, a lot of your decisions are made on how much cash you got in the bank or how much cash you think you're going to have in the bank. And learning all that side and being really disciplined there has been, you know, one of the trickiest parts. So I think a lot of small businesses have that problem, you know, and that's why a lot of small businesses don't survive, you know, longer than 3 years. I think the statistic is the cash flow gets. So we had to be really disciplined with that. And you know, if I'm honest, that's been the hardest part of this whole journey, you know, but also maybe in some ways the most rewarding bit as well.
Yeah, so was that 80's sort of main focus, I guess, coming from the finance background and making sure that you had the no cash flow issues, and you were making sure that your probably ideas were reined in a little bit depending on how much finances have? Because you obviously been working as a team for a long time now. It's obviously really cool to have a husband-wife you know, family business being able to be so successful and be able to run for 8 years. Because as you say, 3 years is sort of the make or break time. People either fold or you keep going, because that's pretty much when you know whether you're going to be able to continue or not. What has that experience been like working with your wife?
Really good question. And actually, Adi won't mind me saying that she doesn't look after the finances.
Okay.
She's good at the trying to force me to spend it. If you'd asked me at the beginning, though, Michael, if I could work with Adi, right at the beginning, I think both of us would have said no way. But she has now become a real valuable member of our team. And I think the key is we now understand each other's strengths and weaknesses and in a business environment, a working environment. So Adi is really good at letting me get on and run the business and come up with the ideas and drive the marketing and the direction of the business. But Adi's strength is she's a critical thinker and she's a doer as well. You know, like once she's made up her mind, she just goes and does it as well. And she's been really encouraging in that way, just to get on and do it. I think actually the turning point for us working together was we got to about 2016 and Adi had enough of the finance industry and our business was growing. We had all these international dealers and I think she came home after a rough day and said, "Oh, geez, I can't keep doing this." And I think I said flippantly, "We'll pack it in. We'll just go on the road for a year and just develop the business overseas." And thinking, "Oh, that'll shut her up. She'll go back to work. This will be great." And the next day she comes home, right, organised it. We've got a career break. I found someone to rent out the house for a year. We're off. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, no mucking around.
Literally, like it was. And we're like, within a matter of a week, we were off. But so then, you know, and this is, we're still talking about a business that's still, you know, hand to mouth financially and, you know, we're just still trying to make ends meet. How are we going to get this? And we had to cart our kids around as well. But doing that for a year, I think both taught us it sort of got ourselves to understand our strengths and weaknesses, but also got Adi involved in the business, understanding it from the outside, getting to know all the great athletes like you. I don't think you would have come across Adi until that year. So when we came back, she just slotted straight into the business with all this knowledge, and now is, you know, she's you know, all the decisions we make together. I might occasionally override her, but I would do that very carefully.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure that you've got about, because as long as your business doesn't come home to the house after work, you should be okay. But did you start the business like in your garage? Was it like a garage type business, or did you have a warehouse straight away? Like from your knowledge from previous brands, how did it all start?
Yeah, I think I'd started downstairs in our house. Actually, you're right. But we had some really nice friends that had a warehouse, and they kindly offered us a little bay, you know, a little pallet bay. And so we put some stock in there and we just were able to go out of there and ship from there every day. And then the one pallet turned into five, and then eventually we moved to another warehouse because we needed more space and they needed more space. And eventually they needed a bigger warehouse, and so did we. So we took over the warehouse. You just got to start small, and you've got to be realistic about what you need to do the job. The other really important person in all of this, we've been, you know, a really good friend of mine, actually one of my best mates' sister, but I've known her since we were young from sailing. Sarah Talos, she's been involved from the beginning, and I think when I started Vicobi, I said, you can come down and just do an hour a week, just pack an order here and there, and all of a sudden it turned into, you know, a day a week, 2 days a week, and it's now turned into a job. And she, you know, she's an important part of the business. All our customers know her really well and love her. And then we've got other people that have come and joined the business since then, and she's sort of had to sort of, you know, get them, you know, manage them and get them involved. So it's been a great journey.
Yeah, it's awesome to see the family businesses running strong and sort of seeing it grow, obviously, through from the downstairs in the house and then moving to a little bit of a warehouse and then actually taking over the warehouse. It just shows how well you were doing with the business. We'll come back to, obviously, the 2016 World Tour, where you probably really built out your distribution network and created that really great relationships. But talking about athletes early on, you had sort of TJ, myself, and then Sean being that world title. How important is like marketing with athletes for a brand that sells technical on-water apparel?
Really, really important. And to be fair, it probably took us a while to understand, do it in a way where everyone got a good return out of it. And but certainly, I think, for us, being involved with some really good athletes was critical. And you know, like we came into a time when it was, you know, everything was Ben and Epic, right? It was all Ben and Epic. It was the Ford and Holden. And we were, I guess we've been lucky in some ways. We've just been a little bit sort of, you know, a little bit like Switzerland. You know, we've been just the guys in the middle that, you know, we do the gear. And getting involved with yourself, TJ, you know, Sean, obviously at the beginning, you know, Rachel Clark, you know, even some local people here from Newport, you know, Max Brooks, Matty Spencer in Surf Life Saving, just having access to these people, Simon Tavish, we've got these access to these people, we can go, right, we've developed this product, here's some prototypes, where, what do you think, what do you like? And we've got, so we can get the athletes sort of feedback on one side, then we can go on to all our dealers and go, we're making this, it's going to be this price. We can tie them together. We can get the performance side on one side, we can get the commercial side on the other. And the athletes are a really important part of that. And you know, we genuinely do really engage them on that.
And what do you seek out from athletes in general? Like, is it like awareness, like their exposure that they have maybe on social media, or is it their personalities, the way that they speak to people and the way that they engage so they can obviously help share and sell the product, the way they wear the product, like what, or the way they help you actually design new products and actually help you create better things and maybe think of new ideas. Like what are the key things, I guess, for any of the young kids out there who are looking to get sponsorships? Like what would maybe be the key three or four things that you would seek in an athlete?
Yeah. Well, all those things you mentioned are important. I think for us, we want our brand to be authentic. We don't want people to wear it because it's been given to them. You know, we want them to actually go, no, I believe in this product because it actually performs and it really does what I love to do. So first and foremost, we want real people. And, you know, we probably use the Paul Ruse, Sydney Swans theory of the no, I can't say it on here, but, you know, that you've got to.
No F-wit rules.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you say?
No F-wit rule.
That's it. That's the one. And so we really stuck to that, our gut on that. You know, when we some people might have come our way and we went, you know what, that's just not, that just weren't a fit for us. So they had to be a fit for us. And they had to be hardworking. I think that's really important. They had to be a hard worker. And they had to understand it was more than just wearing the gear. They had to... You know, everyone's got their own, you know, group of people that they influence. And, you know, that's why you were probably such a great one for us, Michael, because you crossed over so many different disciplines in paddling. And so that was very valuable for us because you were able to influence different segments of the market. And Sean Rice was a classic one. And when he came to us, we'd already started sponsoring Sean. And then about a year or so later, he said, look, we're doing a Paddle Life World Tour of coaching. And you know, he needed some financial support to do that. And I think Kayaks had also signed up and he was asking us. And at the time, it was actually, and it still is, you know, it was a fair financial commitment to support that program. But Sean, to his credit, really embraced it and got to touch a lot of people around the world. And with our brand. So, you know, back, particularly for that first year of it, you know, that was effective. So to ask for young kids as to what they need to do, I think they just need to show that passion for their sport and be nice people. Actually, a really good example of a young kid right now, and he won't mind me saying it, young, is part of the Investec Young Chargers that we've developed with Dean and Yander and obviously Investec. But a young guy by the name of Ben Rees, he's from Newcastle. And, you know, I don't know if you've seen him on Instagram, but, mate, he's posting some great stuff. He'll come up to you at a race and say g'day and want to know what's going on and really personal person. So if I see that they're a really friendly, personal, you know, person that I'd like to hang out with, and they're going to be a great ambassador. So that's what we'd look for sure.
Yeah, I saw Ben paddling out at Blacksmiths just off the Swansea Channel there, which is actually where I learned to ski paddle. So it's quite cool to sort of see the next generation coming through. And I'm pretty sure Matt is his dad. So I was obviously training with Matt when I was first starting ski paddling in between the Swansea and Redhead boat sheds there on Swansea Channel. So it's cool to see obviously another young fella coming through the system down there. And I'm sure there'll be lots of great ski paddlers coming through as the years go by. But talking about 2016, you sort of pack up, your wife comes home and goes, right, we're going to do it. How important was that year for the Vicobi brand? And how important is it to meet different people for your brand and create those trusting relationships where you can actually fall on each other when times get tough or when times get great, everyone sort of wins. And you sort of, the more people you get out to and the more people you reach, the more, I guess, experiences on the water that are, I guess, improving for most people.
Yeah, you know, relationships are everything, aren't they? You know, and we feel so fortunate that we've got all these people that are involved with our business, the athletes, our dealers, and they're all actually very good friends. You know, like we've got friendships as well, and I think, you know, 2016 was probably a big part of that, was where we were able to go and spend blocks of periods of time in regions to really get to know people, to really get to know the market and who are the people that we wanted to get to know and like and enjoy company with, and the athletes. We got to know the athletes. I guess when you start, you know, I was fortunate, I paddled, right? So I obviously go to all the races and when you're competitive, you get to know all the people that are racing and they're our customers. But they're all great people that we've sort of got to know really well. And so that was just, invaluable, just getting to know those people. We got to know Carter Johnson. I'm sure everyone stayed at Carter Johnson's houseboat. I remember.
Yep. I've been there a couple of times.
You know, I remember bailing up there with my kids, my family, going, Carter. Oh, no, he would organize it, but yeah, come and stay at the houseboat, you know, and you know, just funny things like that. But then through that, you know, Carter's created the Gorge, and I could see early on in that event he needed some help just with looking after the sponsors and things like that. And so I sort of helped him out a little bit with that. And you start to get to know all the race organisers, and we really wanted to try and work out ways where we could put back into the sport, you know. And I think that's been a big one, is you can see that all these people are running these races for the love and the passion, and they need help. And I think we were really onto that from the early period where we're like, right, we've got to get involved and we've got to do our bit and be part of this great scene. So I think, going back to 2016, I think, we had a great time. You know, I'm sure you'd ask all my kids, they'd go back tomorrow, but that's not happening.
Yeah, I'm sure it was an amazing few months. You went for like 9 months or something like that, traveling through Europe and through America. What were the key places that you went to, and what did you see in the different markets that you had to sort of, did you have to evolve or change the way that you did things because of the way that people were doing business around the world, or was it because most people are in ocean paddling and it's sort of like a lot of like-minded people? Was it quite an easy sort of flow on effect once you met people?
Yeah, it was more of the same. Like I'd already been going and seeing a lot of these people over the years, but it was more about just being able to spend quality time with them, you know, for periods of time and really getting to know their markets and what their drivers were. But yeah, what we probably learned is we learned a lot about all the other different aspects of paddling and you know, particularly in Europe. Surf ski is growing, there's a lot of potential, but you know, it's certainly not the biggest paddle sport. You know, the traditional brands that are already up there that in our space are far, far bigger. And and just really starting to learn about that. That, you know, Europe, we put a lot of focus on Europe because it is such a big water sport market, always has been, particularly in other brands I've worked for. And so we put a lot of emphasis on that as well as North America. So, but yeah, no, it was a good time. And I think we sort of rolled back it from that trip, you know, pretty motivated with a clear plan as to what we needed to kind of, you know, pursue from a product development perspective and from a strategic perspective.
And you've had a sort of a positivity mindset or marketing play over the past couple of years, and you've sort of been giving back to different events, giving back to obviously like even Invest at Youngers, the Shoreham Partners race team, you're sponsoring I think the Australian Ocean Racing Series and all these different type of events. How important is it to give back to the industry that sort of supports you?
Oh, I think it's critical, and you know, and I know on the podcast it's been well spoken about, you know, guys like in particular Jean Garner and Yander and Shireen and what they've done for the sport. And I think it's one thing to say you're going to do something, but you actually got to, it's about what you do is where it really counts. And I think, you know, if you look at what Dean's done for the sport here in Australia, it's incredible. But, you know, there fortunately, there are Dean Garners in every part of the world. In the Netherlands, there's Ariane Bloom. In the US, there's Carter Johnson. There's all sorts of, you know, characters everywhere. In New Zealand, there's been Garth Spencer and Danica Molam, you know, they're everywhere. There's just people that are passionate about it, and they're not making a quid out of it for running the races anyway. And they, you know, you've got to really chip in. So we looked at ways of how we could support the sport apart from the financial, which we were doing, but more often than not, they need support in other ways. And so often I've just sort of looked at it and said, what do you need a hand with? How can we help you guys? You know, and it could be even, I think the last one, the New Zealand, the King Queen of the Harbour thing, I was commentating, you know, like, or I was running the support boat or whatever, you know, just whatever it is that you can do to help and make the event better. That's, I guess, what you want to do as a sponsor. And wow, hasn't the sport changed, Michael, over the last, or at least surf ski paddling, hasn't it changed over the last 5-6 years?
Oh, well, it's changed hugely just with the amount of interest with other sports sort of going a little bit more downhill, I guess. Like there's obviously different times and different periods of sports where they reach their prime. But yeah, since I started surf ski paddling, like I think I've said a few times on this podcast, when I first started, I was like the youngest guy at like 22 or something like that. Now you've got young sort of, and there was no one around. Like apart from that, there'd be like Corey, who was 2 years older than me. And then there'd be guys who are 30 plus, like the Jeremy Cotters, the Jasper Mockers, the David Mockers, that TJs, Hank McGregor's, those type of names. But there was like a really big disparity, and you sort of have a really, most of the races have a really strong top 10, or maybe at the doctor you probably have a strong top 20. But now you're sort of having a strong top 40, top 50. Like there's guys.
Top 100, mate. We've got this thing. You can't get the top 100.
Yeah, well, I guess for you and JR sort of racing for that top 100, it's a bit different. But there's just so many, there's just been so much more involvement in the sport, and you're seeing amazing sponsors come on board like Investec, Shoreham Partners, seeing the sport grow through guys like Dean Gardner and Oscar Cholopsky going around the world doing like clinics and bringing more people to the sport, and Sean Rice and all these different coaches online are sort of helping bring more accessible paddling to people, different ski brands coming aboard like Kobe creating things. So like, I guess the more people who get involved, the bigger the thing, whole thing grows. And it's just been great to be a part of and sort of see. I've stepped away a little bit from it with the opportunities that were given to me, but I guess I've always been, had a very strong interest and try and do the events that I've had the time to do. But yeah, it's just been an amazing journey, I think, for everybody who's been involved in ocean ski paddling for the past, I guess, 10 years, I guess, since I've been involved.
Oh, yeah, no, it's huge. Well, you know, that's probably not a bad segue into guys like Earl Evans as a guy by the name of Earl Evans that we both know. But, you know, what a force as a sponsor. You like talk about talking a good game, but he actually does it. And we've been so fortunate to sort of get to know Earl. And you know, I think Earl's been a great supporter of us, honestly. You know,
Hugely
supportive of us, and I know of other brands in the sport, but you know, the relationship we've got with the business, I think we've sort of, it's very two way, you know. Earl knows that we're there to help him, and you know, whenever you know, he certainly wants some, you know, some stuff quite often, you know, and you know what Earl's like, he's got a high standard, and so he's forced us to sort of raise the bar in what we produce, in a really good way. And you know, we've got a great relationship. Like, you know, we'll probably talk about the sailing bit, but you know, recently an opportunity came to sponsor an 18-foot skiff for our you know, to develop our sailing range. And Earl had said to me, I wouldn't mind one of those surf skis, one of those 18-foot skiffs, that'd be great. And I said, oh, we'll just wait, Earl, we'll get you a good one. And anyway, this one, a good one popped up last season. And so we said, well, let's go in this together. And Earl was in, you know, all boots and all. And that's the sort of, you know, I think the great relationship we've got with him, but it goes to show that, you know, what he's doing in surf ski is also just so, you know, what a game changer, you know. I think it's, so he's been fantastic for the sport.
Yeah, it's been quite incredible, his involvement and his generosity to the sport, and just being able to be around him, and sort of, he's like a doer as well. He's somebody who gets stuff done, like you say, and he can tell you exactly what he wants straight away. He's like, this is what I want, this is what I want you to do, and just go and do it. And he doesn't like tell you that he wants you to do it anymore, like that you don't get reminded. It's just like, this is what he wants, okay, that's done. And I know, as an athlete or as a person involved in different events or whatever it is that I'm helping out with or trying to help with, I know exactly what I need to do. And he makes a decision and that's final and it's done. Like, there's no posturing over it. There's no like second guessing. There's no like, oh, I said one thing, but I'm actually going to do something else now. It's, I really appreciate being around people like that, and being around successful people, I guess, breeds success as well. And it sort of helps you up your game as well. And that's something that I've been fortunate enough to really be involved with Sean Parnas and with Earl and different guys in the surf ski industry. They've really brought me up and made me really, not only question what I'm doing, but actually make myself better in all aspects, because I want to be like these guys because they are so good at what they do.
You can see how he's been so successful that, you know, he has a clear vision, but, you know, it's all about accountability, and he makes sure everyone is accountable for doing what they, you know, what they've got to do, doing their job. You know, they have the Shore and Partners race team has been, like, that's been such a cool one, Boothie. And I know when we first started that one, I think we'd actually already had the Vicovi race team for a few years, and we were obviously involved with yourself. We weren't involved with Corey at the time. We were involved with Rachel Clark from New Zealand, who's a great athlete, and also Macca as well. And I remember Christmas. It was Christmas holidays. And the phone call from Earl. Yeah, g'day. How you going? Hey, I really think we could do something here, you know. And you know, all of a sudden, I said, oh, well, Earl, I'm in. Let's do it. Whatever it is, let's do it. And you know, within days, the team was formed. We had a plan. We're off. You know, it just happens. And you can learn a lot from a guy like Earl. He just does it. Just gets on with
it.
Yeah. Really cool.
Yeah, and that's something that I guess I've learned over the past few years. It's like, if you have an idea, just go and do it. And if it works, it works. If it fails, it fails. But you don't sit around posturing over it, and don't wait years to get it done. Like, just go and do it. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, there's no harm, no foul. At least you're not thinking about, oh, I wish I tried that idea, because all the ideas that I've tried to do, really, when I followed my gut instincts, it's always worked out. But I guess it was kind of like being a mentor for us, in both of us, in a little bit of a way over the past three, four years. But is there any other mentors? Like, I know JR's been a really big player in your sort of Vicovi, and being a sort of a role model and an advisor for you. How important are mentors, and how important is someone like JR for you?
Mentors are everything. And I think the longer you work, the more you realize, well, it's the longer I tell you running a business, the more you realize how little you know. And there are so many experienced people out there that have had a lifetime of knowledge that they're there and they're willing to impart it. You just got to ask the question and have an interest. And I guess you got to have an interest and understand it. But JR specifically, you know, Justin Ryan, I've got to know, we've got a paddling group. We paddle with Dean Gardner here in Sydney. I'm sure Justin's probably told this story, but you know, we've got a great group of guys and from all walks of life, but I've got to know JR in particular. And JR, he's obviously just done so much in business, just has seen it all. And but he, I think he's got a real interest in consumer brands. You know, I think he likes consumer brands in particular. And he took an interest in our business and in what I was doing from an early age. And so I sort of really was fortunate, and I was able to start to. He became a mentor, you know, very quickly, and I could bounce ideas off him, and he was more than willing to share ideas and things like that. And I think the relationship just evolved over the years to the point where I was like, well, JR, you're a mentor, you should get involved in the business. And fortunately he said yes. And he's got a small stake in the business, but you know, the value for us is JR's experience. And you know, you could go through a period like here at COVID, where, you know, at the beginning, for the first few weeks, no one really knew what was going to happen. But you know, having a guy in your corner like JR who you can talk to and bounce ideas off made it a lot easier and to make the right decisions. And you're not always no one's going to ever get it right, but experience pays. The more you see, the less mistakes you're going to make. And he's become a very good friend, you know, apart from all that too, because we paddle against each other, and there's a couple of us that are all in the same group, and I think we inspire each other to keep paddling. He probably bags me out because I'm a bit younger than him, so I should be going faster, but we've all been paddling for the same time, and we all train about the same amount a week, so I call it even.
Yeah, it's quite interesting hearing about your rivalry from both of you and seeing how excited you both get over it. And that's sort of like the exciting thing about ocean paddling in a way as well, because you have that race within a race and you get to go out there and compete against your mates, but you're really just going out there and having fun and doing your best. But yeah, having different mentors along the way is really important, and having their experiences that sort of teach you along. Like I know there's a whole list of guys that I call all the time when I'm trying to make decisions, and just making sure that I try and make the right ones, and you're sort of picking information from different people and just trying to do your best in pretty much everything you do. And I'm sure that's what you try and do. But what's something that, well, I guess, what are the key things that drive you? Like we've spoken about like determination, spoken about like knowing what you want and your passions, but like each and every day, like what gets you out of bed to go paddling at 5 a.m. with Dean's group, and then go to work, and then trying to expand, I guess, by Kobe, or create new products, or even create something like the Booth Times by Kobe collaboration, and these ideas that you have. What sort of drives you to get all this stuff done?
Yeah, well, I guess the let's talk about the paddling bit. We'll just cross that one off. I think, you know, probably a little bit. You probably feel funny if you don't exercise. Like if you haven't exercised in the day or something, you feel like you've wasted the day. You haven't done what you wanted to do. So for me, that's just like, it's like breathing. You've got to go and do that. And I just, the social aspect of it is huge. The physical and the competitive side is great. That gets you there. And when you're there, that's what pushes you. But the social thing is key, I think. And I think in these days, when being so busy, that's the thing that drives you to go and do that, at least at 5 a.m. anyway, Boothie. But then from a business perspective, what drives us, I think initially you want to be successful. If you're going to do something, you want it to be successful, and to not do it, you want to be an A grader. You want to be a first grader, you know? And I think that's what drives us. I think Vicobi originally, what drove me was survival. You know, we had get the business through the first 6 years, 7 years to survive, you know, and it might sound funny, survival, because it might not seem that way, but growth can add a lot of pressure. As you grow, your inventory, your requirements of the business grow, and so when you're trying to grow a business and you're growing it successfully, it puts a lot of financial pressure. So I think survival was probably the first thing that drove me. And then, but then I think once you sort of get through that, it's about, okay, how can we create something that's going to have a bit of a legacy? How can we create something that can just make people's lives better? You know, like I'm proud that we've got a brand and a product that, It's all about fitness and getting people in the water and being fit and living their lives. You know, I think that's a great thing. You know, it's a positive thing for us as humans. And I'm glad that we've got a brand that's involved in that. And I think it's just about, yeah, how can we keep coming up? I guess what gets me out of bed is how can we do it better? How can we make product that will appeal to more people and function and perform better, really?
Yeah, it's important, that brand identity, and I guess it relates to you with the ocean, and it's something that you enjoy yourself, and you're making other people's experiences better when they get on the water, because maybe they're not just bringing in just different apparel from snowboarding or from running or whatever it is. Like, this is products designed for the sports that we do, and I guess that's really nice to be able to get on the water. And that's why I've loved the brand for so long, is because I really do think it is the best gear, and I'm lucky enough to wear it. And I think that's something that's really fantastic, that you got a brand that sort of resonates well with yourself, with your family, with your mates as well. And that's something that's, I guess, key in anything that we do. But so Booth Times by Kobe range, I'd like to talk a little bit about that. So that came about recently. I guess you just called me, and I've always said to you, like, what can I do more? Like, how can we work together to create something different? And you called me with this idea. So can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, look, I think the Booth by Vicobi, you know, we're starting to see in particularly in the global sports industry, we're starting to see collaborations becoming far more commonplace, and particularly with social media platforms and Instagram and the like. And I think that was an area that I was very keen to explore, but I was keen to explore it with an athlete that had a profile that could touch a large number of people, really. And you know, yourself, you do have that. You know, you've been great in exposing our brand to the stunt paddling community. You obviously, the surf ski one knows you, and you know, and then beyond that, you know, now you're going to have a go at the Avon, and you did some sprint kayaking, etc. You had surf life saving background. So I think for us, you're the right fit for our brand, because that's what we're about. We're about making technical water gear for anything that you're paddling or whatever. If you're doing it for fitness and racing and training, we've got the best gear for you on water. And so I think you are, as a brand, the right fit. And so that's why I gave you a call. And I thought, well, let's, and this is also at the beginning, we had COVID come around, and I thought, well, you know, it's not a bad time to try something new and to get a few projects. So when this happened, we went, right, let's get through a whole lot of jobs that we were sort of not getting through. You know, when you're so busy, it was a great opportunity. We've ticked off quite a few, but this one was at the top of the list. And we launched it last week, Boothie, and we've had an amazing response. It's been awesome to see. To see so many people get involved, and people from around the world actually, that really sort of resonate with your brand. So I'm excited actually with what we've probably got up our sleeve for future creations, that, you know, particularly we can get a bit more bespoke in some of our designs. I think, you know, you've got some good ideas there, which I think we can extend.
Yeah, definitely. We'll keep them under wraps, obviously, because that was sort of the way that we do things now, because I've learned that today. But it's been really cool to obviously just to be able to work with you, and you've got so much experience. And I think your experience and I guess my brand that I'm slowly starting to build, which is something that I did have more time to do during the COVID period. So as soon as you called me, I was like, yep, let's do it. That's something that I've learned to do over time as well. It's just like say yes and work it out. And I got a great graphic designer, Daniel Bork, who from Cyborg, he actually does all my branding and makes me look good as well. So then I get a cool logo and a nice website that looks professional and that type of thing. So that's really important, the way that I guess I present myself to my audience. And it just, I guess the brand for me is just all about determination. It's about passion. It's about having fun as well. And that's they're probably the key three things that I have that people seem to be resonating with. And I think that's been really, really awesome. And something that I guess I enjoy as well, similar to what you were saying earlier with like, you love branding, you love passion, you love your brand and you love seeing people getting involved with it. And that's something that I've been really lucky to be able to do, but probably not being able to focus on it too much because of the amount of racing I'm doing when you're traveling around the world doing 25 races a year or whatever it is in so many different continents, racing on two different continents in one weekend and those type of events that you sort of end up throwing yourself into, you don't get the time to spend as much on it. But something that I guess I will spend more time on as I get older and I maybe start to step away a little bit from not racing, but just in the intensity of the amount of races that I do. So yeah, really excited for the opportunity. And I'm sure we've got some really, really cool, I know we've got some really cool projects coming up and it's nice to be able to launch and just to see how it's all going to pan out. So key successes and failures, like what would you say was your biggest failure when you were starting Vicobia or going through the process of creating Vicobia and growing it?
Yeah, I think I probably have been the first time I'd actually run a business myself. I think I probably expected it to grow quicker than it did. And I think I think I call that a failure because it's funny, success and failure, isn't it? It's just, at the end of the day, it's all experience, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like you win or you learn. That's my favorite quote.
Exactly. So, but you know, whether we call it a failure, but you know, probably expectations of you know how fast we probably could have grown it might may have needed some reality checks early on, but yeah. So I'm sure we've had lots of little mistakes, but we haven't had anything that's been a showstopper, and I think that's probably been our success. We've taken calculated risks and been prepared to make some mistakes that weren't catastrophic mistakes, and maybe the sum of that has led to some of our best successes. You know, I think with products like anything, you're going to have a couple. You know, there's some things that can get out of your control in terms of you've always got to be checking your production and your quality and all those sort of things. And, you know, we've had a few little hiccups over the years, but it's how you deal with those hiccups with the consumer when they do happen. If there is a product, you know, issue, you deal with it. And I think that's how we've been able to really keep our customers and get them to love our brand, because they know that they can trust us, you know, to make quality gear that performs. So but yeah, look, if you ask me what our number one successes have been for the brand, I'd say it's been our ability to embrace so many people around the world in what is a niche sport, and by doing that through our athletes and our teams and people that we've worked with. So I'd say that's probably been our biggest success, and that's given us the foundations for what, you know, I think it will continue to become a great brand.
Yeah. And I think it's obviously that you're allowing yourself to learn along the way. You haven't had any catastrophic failures, I guess, as you're saying, because you've been had the ability to take those calculated risks. And that's something that I look at with everything that I do as well. It's like, you're not throwing yourself in the deep end and just hoping for the best. You're not just basically just buying a lottery ticket, you know, like you're actually making sure that you're creating a pathway, and there's certain avenues it can go, but nothing's going to actually end the business. Was there any point actually when you thought, okay, I don't want to do this anymore? Or is it just sort of continually floated and made it better and better and better?
Oh, definitely. There were times at the beginning where I was like, really, like, just go and get a job.
Yeah.
this is hard. How are we gonna pay the mortgage, all that sort of stuff? Yeah, and so without a doubt, there was times where you were like that. You're like, really, like, how can we make this? You know, you wouldn't show it, but you're like you live and die by your cash flow sheet. So, you know, so I think there was times there where you was questioning, hey, was this the right decision? Without a doubt, particularly in the first sort of three or four years. There were times where you could have got tempted to try and go down a different path, for sure. But I think the passion for what we could create and what we have created, and that dream is what drives you.
And is it something that you've been living and breathing for now since you started? That like, do you do 80-hour weeks? Like, is it a bit more controlled now? Like when you first started, I'm sure there was like weeks where you just work 100 hours. You know, like you'd just be continually working on the business, and then you'd sort of, as you get more people involved, and you've obviously got a good team around you, you've got different sales managers around the world now that are really helping you build the business. Is there any points where you're just like, wow, this is like a lot of work for like maybe no reward, or was it always about, this is what I want to do, this is my passion, it doesn't feel like work?
Yeah, well, there is that. Like, no matter what, when you're passionate about what you do, you it's not work, right? You, like, AD and I often joke that Vicovi is our third child. You know, it's really what it is. And it is, yeah. Really. It's probably a bit sad, we're a bit so emotionally attached to it, but no, we are. But but yeah, look, I think there are times, look, you know, we have got a bit more disciplined at that, you know, at the actual work stuff, you know, and sort of making sure that we give ourselves the time and the space to do our other things that we love to do. And that's what paddling's obviously, you know, it's related, but it is a passion of mine, and family obviously is first. But there's not a moment that it's not just something's ticking away in your brain about thinking about how you do this better or differently. It doesn't stop. You'll wake up at 2 a.m. and it'll hit you. And I'm not sure if that's healthy or not, but I'm sure it's like you, Michael. You're always thinking about what you could be doing differently and better. So
it is a really hard thing. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs, business owners, or athletes in general really have this issue, or have this great issue that we have, because we always want to do better. But how do you know, like in your business, when enough is enough? Like, because you can constantly improve things, and that's the hardest thing to know, because there's been different product managers or different CEOs or business owners that I've spoken to so far. There has to be a point where you go, all right, that is good enough. Like, I know I can probably do like these 10 things, maybe slightly 1% better, you know, like there might be a stitching here or a different garment, maybe 1 centimeter pull here or something like that, maybe in your business. But when do you know when to stop? Because that's a really hard thing to do.
It is. No, you're right. Like, you know, there has to be, and also when you're making product, you can go and make the Rolls Royce product, but the consumer can't afford, or maybe doesn't want the Rolls Royce. They probably want the Audi or something like that. And so it's all those things trying to put that together. But when to stop? Yeah, I don't know. I think you always, that's the fun bit, isn't it? The bit that we, you're constantly going, okay, what can we do next? What can we do next?
Yeah.
And how can we do that better? And is this working well and this is not? I think AD's been very helpful for me to try and stop and appreciate, you know, what we do. And because, you know, I think if you listen to a lot of, you know, very successful people, they're always thinking about what they can do next. And I think that never stops. But I think it is important sometimes to stop and go, oh, okay, that was really cool, and celebrate that, you know, and I think maybe we're getting a little bit better at that.
Yeah, because there is a limit to when you want to place that order with the supplier and whether you want to tweak that little bit more, you know, like I know that's with me, like there's always these like things that I want to do. And like, even with training, it's like, could I do more? Could I do this? Could I do that? It's like, no, this is the plan. This is the procedure. This is, I guess, your project management that you've worked out what you want to do and what you want to achieve. And this is the end date. So this is where you stop now. And this is when you go and race, or this is when you go and put your product to market. So I'm sure you have those issues. But when you created Vicovi Sailing, now this must have been a really cool thing for you, obviously moving into the niche market of ocean sports for I guess 4 or 5 years, and now going into what you were passionate about for, let's say, 18 years, as we said earlier. It must have been really exciting to start to get involved in sailing. Like, you spoke about the Shore & Partners skiff and the Vicovi skiff that you had out on Sydney Harbour. I saw those amazing shots that you got taken. But what was it like creating a brand that something that you were also passionate about?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? And the sailing thing was always probably something that was in the back of our mind that we'd like to do, given that, you know, what I'd done to date. But yeah, I think for me, I've gone into the sailing thing with a bit of a different perspective than I have with Vicovi and paddling. We're probably going into a space that's got a lot more competition. You know, there are some established players there. Having said that, I think a lot of the existing players are all quite mature businesses. They might be, you know, owned by, you know, investment firms and stuff. And so there's not that many small and nimble players in the market. And I think that's probably our opportunity. Well, that's definitely the opportunity that I see, where we can be a little bit like what Vicobi has been in paddling. We can be on the ground and intuitive and connected to the market. So it's exciting. At the same time, I'm going into it, and we, you know, we've made some really good inroads in the first season that we've launched it. But I'm going into it with some healthy, I'm just going into it with my eyes open, knowing what I know, and making sure that we're taking the calculated risks. We're sort of making sure that the brand identity remains. And I tell you what has been really cool is that the cross-pollination of water sports. I'm just seeing it so much now. I think this is probably playing into our hands with Vicobi, is that people that sail, paddle, they'll kiteboard, they'll foilboard, they'll windsurf. And you know, you talk about some of those America's Cup guys, like, you know, Kai Hurst is a good example. You know, actually, he came out the other day with us at Collaroy. But, you know, he's got a whole lot of these America's Cup guys all paddling skis, and they foilboard. And I think that cross-pollination bit is where Vicobi exists. And I think that's our connection line. We're just in our small markets that we've pushed Vicobi into for sailing domestically here, like literally here in Sydney, and Australia wide, we've had some great success. So I'm quite optimistic of what we can achieve, but we're doing it in a nice calculated way, which can give us some longevity that I think we can achieve in the long run.
Yeah, it must be really cool to see that sort of cross-pollination. And I guess in a way that you were, when were you, actually, this, I don't think I asked this question. How did you get introduced into ocean ski paddling? Like, I know that you had the old Burton and the ski when you were sailing, but when did you actually start to get involved? I don't think I asked this question earlier on.
That's a good question, actually. I know some sailing mates of mine when I was younger, we all had like these spec skis. So it was just something that we did, because everyone around here on the Northern Beaches has got a ski somewhere, you know, under their house or in the garage. So not hard to get hold of one. And so, yeah, just some sailing mates, we would just jump on them for a bit of fun. And then I've got another really good mate of mine, Niall Kinch. He's a paddler. He paddles with us as well. And I've known Niall for a long time. And he's been a good mate of mine. Well, I'm always bouncing ideas. We're both bouncing ideas off each other. But he's a really good sailor and also a good ski paddler. And I think he was probably a really good guy that really introduced me to going and doing Dean Squad and getting me more involved in the sport. So certainly in the first stages, I'd say Niall has probably been one of the guys that have helped me.
Yeah, it's cool to hear that story, because I didn't really know how you got involved, because obviously you have this massive sailing background. I know you through Vicobi, but I didn't know how you actually got involved in ski paddling. So that's another good story to get out there. So the cross-pollination of Vicobi with Vicobi Paddle, Vicobi Sail, and who knows what else Vicobi will be in the future. It's been great to actually see the different products, because I look at some of the products, I'm like, oh, I could probably use that for this and that for this. And even though it's not necessarily for paddling, it's like, oh, but that, like, especially like the wetsuit style, long john. Yeah, because I've been using that for the SUP sort of tech paddling, and when it's a little bit colder, because it's like quite thin and it keeps you really warm, because there's no sort of cut off through the middle. And that's been a really like game changer for me, because I really enjoyed that product. But there's obviously a few different ones with the wind jackets and the singlets and the pogies and all those type of different things that you're able to sort of get access to now. There's just been an amazing, I guess, improvement of products as you've gone along. But what's the future for Vicobi look like? And what I guess, is there any goals that you're sort of really trying to achieve in the next sort of 3 to 5 years, or is it just keep on keeping on?
Yeah, look, I know. I think we want to just continue our path in paddling 100%. Like, first and foremost, we've built a great brand that's got a nice, strong position in paddling. And I think we want to just cement that and really, you know, particularly in the European market, we see some opportunities there and in the North American as well. But certainly, yeah, our focus on paddling, you know, we want our brand to still just, you know, keep pushing in that space and becoming stronger there. And then we want to continue getting that sailing space going and getting that interesting becoming a player in there that's unique and we can create our own space in that market. I think that's what we're really trying to do in the short term. And then I think also just evolving as a business, technology is changing. And you know, we've been so lucky to start Vicovia in a time which, you know, like if we started Vicovia 20 years ago, the costs associated to do what we do would have been way too high to achieve it. And technology is a big part of that. And it's changing all the time. And the landscape's changing with all our dealers. But we've got a great, you know, our philosophy is to make sure that our product is accessible as it can be. And, you know, we want anyone in any given region where they do their sport to be able to locate and find Vicovia gear. And I think we want to just keep doing that no matter what they do, whether they paddle, they sail, they surf, they foil, whatever it is. And I think that's what we want to try and see. And going a little bit on that cross-pollination path that you talked about there, you know, gear that we make for one sport can work on the other sport. And I think blurring those lines.
Yeah, absolutely. And just trying to create different products for different environments or on the water, because I guess Vicovia Ocean Performance is a water sports brand now. It's not just a paddle sport. It's not just a sailing brand. There's all these different avenues you're going down. And I'm sure we can do great things with the Booth Times Vicovia stuff as well. But what's your opinion on online versus bricks and mortar, or online versus distributors? Like, or is there a good place for all of it?
We'll get first of all the terminology. So yeah, if you look at retailers like shops, and then distributors, which would be traditionally people that might be a distributor for a country or region that then distribute to the shops, I feel that model, the distribution model is getting very outdated. The layers, you can't afford to have those sorts of layers in the path to the consumer anymore. So I think, you know, increasingly you're not seeing that the distributors managing a region or a country so much. There are exceptions, you know, where you'll find, like, let's say Japan's a good example because language barriers and things like that. You do need a distributor there still.
Yeah.
So I think first of all that's changed a lot, and online's had a lot to do with that. Bricks and mortar versus online, I think, yeah, without a doubt, you can certainly see online, you know, it's growing, and COVID has obviously enhanced that slightly. For us, I think we're in a specialty game where people need advice. They need to go to a shop to buy their boat, to buy their paddle, to buy their gear, and they want advice and they want to see what's on offer. And I think in the specialty game that we're in, I feel like that still needs to be there. And what you're seeing the good guys get stronger, and you're seeing the weak guys go away. And so that's what I'm seeing. I'm seeing the good guys get better. And to us, they have increased value because of what they have. And then we have great partnerships with them. But then look, all of them have a good online strategy themselves. So they're clicks and mortar in many ways. So it's an interesting space. I, you know, people say it's all got to be online, 100% online. I disagree. I think that for our particular product, I think that look and touch and advice is still going to be important. But online, without a doubt, is coming, and you've got to be strong at both games.
Yeah, it's definitely a major thing, especially in the gear or technical apparel, as you call it, for surf ski paddling. You've got to really touch it. You've got to feel it, because you've got to know which product to use in which environment. And that's something that I've been able to learn, because I'm lucky enough to have all the gear from you guys. And I know, like, when I wake up in the morning, I look at my phone and I check the temperature outside, and then I'm like, okay, I need to wear this, you know, like it was 9 degrees this morning. So base layer, I wore the wind vest in case it was windy, and I took that off. And then I have the long V-cole pants, and I have a pair of booties as well. So you just know what you need to wear. And most of the time I overheat, but I'm way happy if I overheat than whether I'm freezing out there on the water. So it's really cool to know that no matter what conditions I have, I'm going to be warm. Like whether I'm racing in the freezing cold in Paris in December, or whether I'm racing in the heat in Hawaii in July, there's there's always a product that I can wear from the Vicobi range, which is really good to know because it's something I just don't have to worry about when I'm going to events. Going forward, is there anything else that you wanted to add in here today? Like, was there any key things that we didn't speak about? Well, we've covered a lot, but
I think we've covered it all. This has been a great one, Boothie. Thank you for the opportunity, though, mate. It really has been. It's been fun to actually just reflect back a bit because I think Vicobi is really a culmination of all my life experiences coming together, and so it was fun to actually to have to think about it a bit and put it down on paper.
Yeah, it's been great chatting with you today. If people want to find out more, it's Vicobi.com or at Vicobi on Instagram and same on Facebook. Is that right?
That's correct, mate. Now you're very good at your social media, Michael. Keep it up.
Well versed. All right. Well, thanks, mate. And thanks to everybody out there watching and listening along. This has been obviously a great whole series to do with different business people, sports people. If you want to check it out on the podcast networks, Apple Podcasts or Spotify, if you want to watch Boothcast or check out my website. So thanks everyone for watching today. If you have any suggestions on who I should bring on next, please let me know. And Pat, thanks again for all your time this morning.
Thank you, Michael. Have a good day, mate.
Cheers, you too.